Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now, on Last Call, live from Philadelphia, terminated. Google firing employees after a heated protest, why a wider crackdown could be coming to corporate America. Two guys, the same plan? How Biden and Trump's economic plan look similar. Paramount may have another suitor, and the stock is moving right now. We have the breaking developments. Housing dreams dashed. New real estate data you have to see. Plus, battling back the shorts, how shares of DJT are suddenly mounting. An epic rally. Herb Greenberg is here. And running out the clock, a critical window about to close in the race for the NBA TV rights. All that and more over the hour, so belly up or buckle up, Philadelphia style. Last Call is up right now. Good evening, everybody. From the heart of the city of brotherly love, I am Brian Sullivan. All right, all that ahead, but first up on Last Call, Netflix numbers are out, and they are taking the entertainment industry by storm. Now, on the surface, results fairly solid. Look at those numbers. It beat on both revenue and earnings, and in a key metric, Netflix added more than 9 million new subscribers in the first quarter. That is far more than expected. But Netflix stock is down right now. 4.5%. Why? Well, because Netflix is essentially blowing up the way it and maybe other streaming giants have reported their numbers for years. Netflix says it will stop reporting quarterly subscription numbers beginning in the first quarter of next year. It will also stop reporting what's called average revenue per member. Those numbers play big roles in how Wall Street and investors judge Netflix and the other streaming media companies. Co-CEO Greg Peters speaking out on the earnings call about the decision.
You know, number of members times the monthly price is increasingly less accurate in capturing the state of the business. So this change is really motivated by wanting to focus on what we see are the key metrics that we think matter most to the business.
So what does this mean for Netflix, investors, maybe like you, and Hollywood? Moving forward, let's talk about it to kick off the show. Joining us now is SPG Global Principal and former Netflix and Hulu executive Simon Gallagher and Mark Douglas. He is not only the CEO of Mountain, which tracks digital TV ad spend, he is a previous winner of the CNBC Stocks Draft, and he won in part by picking Netflix. So, Mark, we'll start with you. You picked them twice, by the way. I think you won one year on that. Would you pick Netflix again, or does this decision change the way you look at the company and the stock?
I won with Netflix the first year. The next year, I lost to NVIDIA. But that's last year. Netflix is up over 80%. I would pick Netflix again, but I wouldn't expect 80% year-over-year returns. I think the stock has quite a bit of room to grow, but your expectation should be more like 25% growth, which at their scale is an insane amount of growth in the price. They're creeping towards $1 trillion. So it's a great stock to still own, and I would absolutely continue to own that stock.
Simon, should we care that they're going to stop posting those subscriber numbers in a year?
Look, you always want as much information as you can get about any company that you're going to invest in. So this is not a positive for investors, but I completely understand the reasoning behind it. And I think what Greg said in the earnings call is it's just not a true reflection of how the business is doing. So they don't want people to focus on it too much.
Yeah. And Brian, the reason...
Go ahead.
The reason they don't want to report the numbers is you can only squeeze so much out of password sharing. It's the most leveraged move in business. They probably took two software engineers and said, make it harder to share passwords, and they produced all this growth out of it. But at a certain point, there's not many more people sharing the passwords. So, and the growth in the subscribers is going to slow a bit, but I don't think that the overall growth in the business has to slow. So that's why they just don't want to report that anymore. That's the true reason.
Well, what's the growth, Mark? What's the growth then, quote, in the business if it's not more subscribers because they're, to your point, whacking password sharing, and pretty much everybody probably already has Netflix. So where is the growth coming from?
Well, there's two things. So one is definitely international. They don't doesn't monetize as well as the United States, but I think, you know, they have a quarter of a billion people using Netflix and 8 billion people on the planet. I think they can probably have a few more people, like, you know, want streaming entertainment. And then the other big thing is they have the advertising business, but they've literally just scratched the surface of monetizing that. There's a lot of growth coming from that. Yeah. And all of this flows to the bottom line. They are at a critical mass now where every incremental dollar revenue has an outsized effect on their profitability. And that's where the growth in the stock is going to come from.
You know, listen, Simon, we've got a streaming product. Disney's got a streaming product. I mean, everybody probably and their mother has a streaming product at this point. Netflix still does appear, though, to be the king of the media hill. Is it still really Netflix's world and everybody is just kind of living around it?
Absolutely. You're talking significantly larger in terms of subscribers, significantly larger than everyone other than YouTube. In terms of viewership, in streaming viewership, they're at about 8.1% of all streaming viewership in the United States. The only one higher is YouTube at about 9.7%. Everyone else is at best a quarter of that. So are they the king at the moment? Yeah, absolutely. And I also think there's a number of categories that are still open space for them to go into. They control such a huge number of subscribers, of credit cards, and if they want to launch a new product and a new category in media, I think they'd do very well.
All right, on a different topic, Mark, the compensation packages for the two CEOs, you got Greg Peters, who we just saw, and Ted Sarandos, also coming to light through a recent proxy report, Sarandos taking in just shy of $50 million, most of that, of course, in stock. Peters' pay package is a little bit less, about $40 million, again, most of that in stock. Mark and Simon, to you after that, you have a reaction? Are those fair numbers?
I personally think, for given the scale of the company, the global impact of the company, and the growth potential of the company, most specifically, that's a pretty fair package for that level. I think some people could say it could be higher than that, given the amount of potential growth that's on the horizon.
Simon, did you agree with that?
Couldn't agree more. If you look at the performance of the company relative to what David Zaslav's been paid at Warner Brothers Discovery, I think this number is very fair. And Netflix is also renowned for paying all their executives above market rates. So it doesn't surprise me the numbers are at the level that they are.
All right, Simon and Mark, really appreciate the views there. Netflix stock moving down about 5% right there. All right, so that is kind of the micro, folks. Let's get the macro and see what happened to your money today. And a little bit of a gain for the Dow, but the Dow is not the story. The story is the S&P 500. Because while it only fell 0.2%, that is the fifth straight day that it's fallen. And that actually, my friends, the longest losing streak in 5 months. NASDAQ down a lot more, down about 0.5%. All that, by the way, is interest rates and the U.S. dollar continue to climb nearly every single day. All right, inside the market, your stud and dud du jour, the big winner of the day, Genuine Parts, up 11%. Strong quarter there, the big decliner. Look at that. Las Vegas Sands down almost 9%. Disappointing investors. Stock sank to its worst day in a year. All right, we're just getting started here. I'm live from Philadelphia. Coming up, action. Another suitor now reportedly in the mix for Paramount, and that stock is on the move a lot. Plus, getting the boot. Google staffers fired as protesters going after the tech giant, and they were having none of it. Could more of corporate America soon follow suit?
People people today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
All right, let's get out of tomorrow's news tonight. And tonight, we're talking Paramount. Sony Pictures and Apollo Global Management are in discussions to team up for a joint bid to buy Paramount. That is according to the New York Times. No official bid has been submitted yet, and Paramount is still in exclusive talks with Skydance Media. But Paramount shares are surging on the news. Right now, they're up 11.5%. With us tonight for more, CBC Media reporter Alex Sherman. Alex, what can you tell us about this report?
You know, it's interesting that Sony is a player here because Sony is what in the media industry people call an arms dealer, right? They have no streaming service, unlike Disney or Paramount or Warner Brothers Discovery or our parent company. And Paramount has a large streaming service, Paramount Plus, that has over 60 million subscribers. So if the deal, in fact, goes away from Skydance Media, which we do not know that it will, as you mentioned in the intro, they're an exclusive talk, so they're still in the driver's seat. But if for some reason that deal collapses and it moves toward a Sony Apollo bid, you do have to wonder what the future of Paramount Plus might be. Would Sony shut down that service and make Paramount a pure arms dealer like Sony has been? That's, I think, the most strategic, interesting implication of a potential deal if it does go in that direction.
Yeah, and it's a really fascinating point, and I don't know the Paramount Plus streaming numbers. Maybe you do. We just talked about Netflix. I'm not imagining they're fantastic, by the way, but maybe they are, and I'm wrong, and you could tell me if I am wrong. But what would that give Sony? And then also, I noticed the report in the Times said really no mention of CBS. You know, Paramount is CBS, CBS Sports, CBS News, MTV, Nickelodeon, not just the movies. Sony doesn't want CBS.
Well, look, I mean, Apollo may have plans for CBS. You know, this would be a joint bid. It is possible, of course, that CBS could be divested, especially if Paramount Plus is shut down. So the first part of your question, Paramount Plus has almost 70 million subscribers. So it's popular, but it's still money losing. That's the problem. It's been money losing for years. So it loses less money than it used to, but it has never really been a winner for Paramount Global. So that would be the logic, per se, in shutting it down. If you just decided, you know what, we're never going to get to escape velocity on this thing, like Amazon Prime Video or Netflix, these big global streaming services. So are we just spinning our wheels here? Or does it make sense to just license out all of our content? And now we have Paramount content that you can, you know, kind of lock into the Sony content, and now you're a really major, by far the largest arms dealer of scale. So I do think that's a strategically interesting deal. But look, Skydance, as long as they have exclusivity, is still in the driver's seat here. The problem is there's been a lot of external pressure around that deal from Paramount Global shareholders, even some board members stepping down that say, hey, wait a minute, the better deal here would be to sell all of Paramount Global and give all of Paramount Global shareholders a premium on their shares.
70 million. I stand corrected. And they still can't make money. But that's a lot more than I would have thought. Very quickly, NBA, media rights, negotiations. The Miami Heat were in my hotel, or I was in theirs, last night here in Philadelphia. I wanted to sort of ask Spoelstra what's going to happen, but I was too much of a coward. You're reporting on this. What's going to happen with TV rights and the NBA?
So somewhat expected here, but what I'm reporting is that there will not be a deal done by the incumbent players, which are WarnerMedia Discovery, which owns Turner Sports, and Disney, which owns ABC and ESPN, by Monday, April 22nd. That is the day that the exclusive negotiating rights window closes, which means the NBA can now start talking to other partners to potentially bring them in to a deal. For months and months, I've reported that the NBA wants a third partner here, a robust streaming partner, whether that's Amazon or Peacock or Apple or, you know, even Netflix out of the box, who knows? Probably Amazon, I would say, is the favorite of that bunch. That would be a third party, maybe even a fourth partner for, say, the in-season tournament could be involved here. And maybe our own parent company, NBC Universal, could, say, take the place of a Warner Brothers Discovery. So all of that becomes on the table after Monday, April 22nd, next week. So what I'm reporting is no deal will be done with the incumbents by then.
Well, the TV ratings have not been great, Alex. In person has been great for the NBA, but the ratings...
A little up and down recently. Longer term, though, live sports is still very valuable, popular live sports, because of the advertising. Yeah. You can't skip the commercials, news and sports.
Well said. Alex Sherman, breaking news. Appreciate it. Thank you. All right, in the meantime, buddy. A big story in corporate America. Google firing 28 employees. It's after a series of outbursts and even a sit-in at the company. Some workers apparently upset because Google is doing business with the government of Israel on a cloud computing project. An internal memo obtained by The Verge from Google's head of global security says, quote, behavior like this has no place in our workplace and we will not tolerate it. We are a place of business. The small group of now former workers argue they have the right to political protest at the office and say the firings were clearly retaliatory. It's important to note that protests at Google are really not new. In 2018, employees successfully pushed the company to shelve a contract with the U.S. military after voicing their discontent. But today's dramatic move, let's be clear, may not just be about Google. It actually calls into question maybe something bigger. Are companies finally flexing back after a few years where employees pretty much had all the power? With us tonight for more, The Verge deputy editor Alex Heath. He has been covering and writing about that story extensively. Alex, great reporting, as always. Dramatic move. How shocked are you and your sources on what Google did?
I think the really shocking thing was seeing 28 employees fired here. I've been covering tech for a long time. You see these selective firings, but you don't see something that's like 28 from a company like Google. That was to send a message. The memo was very stern. You read part of it. Part of it was basically warning, hey, if anyone here is thinking about doing something like this again, know that we will take quick action. They not only fired the people who were refusing to leave the offices, including the office of the CEO of Google Cloud. There were 9 arrested for that the day before this memo was sent. But then they arrested 28. They fired 28. So they fired people who were just involved, but not even refusing to leave physically the premises. So yeah, absolutely sending a message. And as you said with Google, you know, this is not new for them in terms of having protests, but the sit-in aspect of this, where employees were literally staying in offices, refusing to leave, was certainly something new and shows how heightened this topic is.
Yeah, we're looking at the pictures now. I mean, they were not hiding it. These are employees that they do have the right to protest, obviously, outside of the office. But free speech rights, I don't think they we're told all day long and twice on Sunday, stuff you're not allowed or supposed to say inside of an office for a variety of reasons. And they were not only protesting, but they were bragging about it. They were putting it out there. And my guess is, and tell me if you know anything about this, Alex, Google is probably afraid it's going to cost itself. That could cost it money, or it could push away potential billion-dollar partners who worry that maybe, you know what, Google's too political. I can't risk that.
I think this Israel government cloud contract that they were protesting is not actually something Google's worried about. It's not a lot of money for Google. I think the real problem here is that there has been this cultural uproar within Google really over the last year, and it stems from a lot of things, not just something like this, but they have a lot of unease in the ranks. And I think they saw, wow, you know, we are no stranger to protests, employees protesting outside peacefully and orderly and lawfully, right? As you pointed out, there's a difference. But now we've got employees refusing to leave the offices of our executives until they are literally handcuffed and dragged out by police. That's just a new escalation. And And I think Google was trying to push back really firmly by telegraphing to the world, hey, we just fired 28 of you, which, again, I don't think I've ever seen in the history of big tech.
Yeah, I think it's flexing, taking back the power. Alex, another story that you are following, Facebook parent Meta is putting its artificial intelligence, AI assistant, onto its social media platforms, and they are doing a deal with Google. You reported on the latest updates and had the opportunity to speak with Mark Zuckerberg. What is the, I know what the goal of Google is, what is the goal of Facebook here?
I mean, look, everyone has ChatGPT fever, especially in big tech. They think that everyone is going to increasingly want to interact with the internet and the world around us through these AI agents. And Mark Zuckerberg told me he wants Meta to be the leading player here. He thinks that because of the scale of the platform they have, over 3 billion daily users, that they can eclipse even the inertia that ChatGPT has right now. And he did this deal with Google where they're the first chatbot to have Google results and Bing results in the same bot. And he mentioned that there was some kind of money changing hands here, but it sounds like Meta may just be paying Google a small amount. But it shows how Google is really focused on getting search in AI. They have Gemini. But this is the first time I've seen them do this kind of a search deal with another chatbot.
Can you imagine the amount? We got to go, but can you imagine the amount of data and personal information that Google and Facebook together have? It's got to be all the information. Alex Heath, The Verge, thank you. All right, on deck. Economically, are they kind of basically the same guy? How Trump and Biden's economic plans are looking the same. Hard to believe, but true, and that's next.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
All right, here's a question to get you going. Are the two guys really kind of the same economically? President Biden campaigning in Pennsylvania this week. In fact, he was here in Philadelphia earlier today as he tries to win or keep the vote of this critical state. It's one of the most important states for the election. And in this, he appears to be becoming more and more Trump-like. Case in point, yesterday in Pittsburgh, Biden called for potentially tripling tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. This would add on to tariffs that already exist from the previous administration. The steelworkers union vote could be critical for both guys. So while there certainly are issues where they differ, mostly social issues, border security, and foreign policy, are their domestic economic messages relatively similar? Joining us now is MSNBC political analyst and former HUD Secretary Julian Castro, an economic analyst and columnist at the American Enterprise Institute, and CNBC contributor Jimmy Pethakoukas. Julian, I'll start with you. I know it sounds a little bit crazy, but both are sort of pro-tariff. Both are stopping cheap Chinese imports. We're not seeing a whole lot of difference on the tax side. Are they maybe closer in their populist tone than we may think?
Well, Brian, I mean, I think what you have right there is that President Biden is going to do everything in his power to make sure that we have fair trade. That means getting tough on China when it makes sense. But I would say that the similarities with Donald Trump end there. I mean, in Biden, we have a president who at the beginning of his tenure had an unemployment rate of 6.4%. Today, it's 3.8%. It's near a historic low, has created millions of new jobs. Trump was the first president since Herbert Hoover to oversee a net loss of jobs. In addition
to
that,
COVID. I mean, Julian, to be fair, all those numbers were COVID. That's not, can't make that comparison.
Well, then compare it on a different scale, though. Trump talked about Infrastructure Week for 4 years and never got it done. Biden got a huge investment in infrastructure that's creating thousands of jobs for Americans all over the country done. He got the CHIPS Act done that is bringing back manufacturing to the United States. That's something that Trump talked about but never actually got done. And Biden has said and has lived up to being the most pro-union president in the history of our country. So he's delivering on what he promised and also bringing results as we've seen the unemployment rate come down, we're seeing inflation come down, the economy heading in the right direction as we head toward November.
And maybe Jimmy, I should have flipped it and said that Trump was becoming more Biden-like in a way, because Trump, you know, I mean, ostensibly he's a Republican, but he was a Democrat most of his life. I don't know what he is. But the point is that he's slapping tariffs on. He's doing these sort of protectionist things. When he was in office, they're both of them just running up debt like nobody cares, because let's be honest, most of the people making decisions aren't going to be the ones to pay for this down the road. But I don't see a huge economic difference between the two candidates. Do you?
Listen, if you're an American voter and you like trade protectionism and you like industrial policy and you really don't care about the debt, you have two phenomenal choices, maybe the two best choices in American history on those three policies, which generally American presidents have not followed those policies. But that's what we have. And sure, are there differences? I think taxes are a difference. And you can say that President Biden got some things done that President Trump didn't. But when it comes to those, I think, key issues, how they feel about trade, or let's say broadly, economic populism. And populism tends not to care about debt. They tend to tell voters what they want, especially if they're, you know, worried about winning those voters. That's what we're getting from both of these gentlemen.
Yeah. Julian, if you were advising the president, would you say to him, you need to be a little more populist, in not that kind of populist, but I know today he was in Philadelphia and he went to a Wawa, which is like if you're out west, like a Circle K or a 7-Eleven here on the East Coast in Pennsylvania, kind of a heavily scripted short thing. But he has to deliver the message that I'm taking on inflation, right? To Ron Klain's memo's point, it can't just be about bridges and infrastructure week.
Well, I mean, the good news there, Brian, is that the results are there. Inflation is coming down and Americans more and more are feeling that. Not only that, that from the middle down, people have felt wages increasing more than they have in the last few years. So that's also good because people's purchasing power starts to increase. But I don't think that Biden needs advice on these things because this is in his bones. This is who he is. This is how he grew up. He grew up in a hardworking household. He understands the concerns of working families across the United States. That's been his whole agenda. Whether we talk about taxation or these tariff policies or making a push to build the economy from the middle out, as he has said and done over and over. So, you know, he doesn't need any advice on it. He does need to make sure between now and November that the voters know about the accomplishments of the administration, and also that it's not just about the past, it's also about the future. Just like he did in the State of the Union, he needs to keep laying out how he's going to create more jobs, more opportunity for folks, make sure that both workers and American business are able to thrive.
Maybe he needs a smidgen of advice, because a lot of working families and a lot of union members who you say he's doing great, he's pro-union president, they seem to like President Trump quite a bit. Maybe not the union leaders, but rank and file members, they like President Trump the way they haven't liked a Republican since Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I to that point, when I was out at the UAW, I spent about 12 hours with a number of UAW workers when the president came in. And, you know, they would sort of whisper to me, like, we're not, the UAW can say what it wants, but as human beings, we have not maybe made up our mind. It's hard to believe it's only mid-April, Julian and Jimmy. We got a long way to go in this.
Oh, man.
So I have a feeling we will be back. We got a long way to go. Guys, thank you very much. Appreciate you both. All right. Coming up, call it the decade of living dangerously. Questions swirling over what is next with Iran. But could investors, you, be missing a far bigger development? That's next. All right, time for another episode or issue, whatever, of Sully's Stats. Something that sticks out to me are our last call team. And today we're going to call this the four C's. And they are crude, copper, coffee, and cocoa. And all four C's continue to go up in price. Cocoa up this year, 163%, topping $11,000 a ton. Coffee up 23%. Copper up 14%. And crude oil up 15%. All just this year. since January 1st. These are big moves. And the U.S. dollar, by the way, is moving higher as well. Remember, this is not just annoying and inflationary, but it is those things too. But it also makes big parts of our energy infrastructure build-out a lot more expensive. Of course, copper goes into all the power lines, but also oil and gas-based parts are a big deal in many things. Plastics, metals, whatever, etc. So those costs are going up, and it is something to watch. And maybe we'll add a fifth C to that, and we will call it costly. Because 2024 appears to be the year of pulling stuff out of the ground, or maybe pulling stuff that's in the ground. We're watching the four C's. All right, in the meantime, the Biden administration imposing new sanctions on Iran and its reaction to Iran's dangerous attack on Israel last weekend. These sanctions targeting Tehran's missile and drone program. Biden also releasing a statement on this, warning groups who support Iran's attack, saying, quote, "We are committed to the security of our personnel and partners in the region, and we will not hesitate to take all necessary action to hold you accountable." But will these sanctions actually impact Iran, which, despite already existing sanctions, have still been able to surge their oil production and thus their cash flow to give them more money to fund terrorism? With us tonight for more is Atlantic Council President and CEO Fred Kemp, also a CNBC contributor. Let's start on Iran, Fred, and welcome to the program. President's got to walk a pretty doggone tight line between this, Israel, and some of the domestic issues around Israel, i.e. votes in Michigan, that he is facing.
So Brian, first of all, I love that you showed that chart. If you look at Iran's production, it is the highest they were at a 6-year high in the first quarter. And that's despite all these sanctions. We've written about this as the axis of sanctions evasion, and that's China and Russia and Iran, and China buys 90% of Iran's oil. So these new sanctions are more symbolic than they're going to be disruptive. Iran's already the most heavily sanctioned country on earth, both by the United Nations and the U.S. This hits areas that have already been hit before, UAVs and steel and the Iranian Republican Guards. It's better that they're being done than they're not being done. But unless one cracks down on sanctions evasion, which you can only do through secondary sanctions on China and Russia, then you're not really going to get at the issue that you're pointing to, which is Iran's income from its oil, which is as high as it's been in the last 6 years.
Well, sanctions did work in the past. And this, of course, COVID took a hit on the oil, too. But this was before. We bring up that chart. This is in 2018 and 2019, pre-COVID, where their output did collapse. How much of this, and we'll get to more on China in a second, goes to the issue of China, because China is a massive buyer of Iranian oil. And by the way, if you're going to produce oil, you need somewhere to sell it.
Well, it goes to two issues. It goes to the issue of U.S. elections, and the White House isn't in a very good mood to actually take actions that are going to increase the price of gas at the pump. So that's number one. And if you're really going to go after Iran, if you're really going to go after Russia, you're going to have higher oil prices. The second thing is obviously the fact that these countries are working more closely and better together than they have in my memory. Everyone talks about the 1930s, where you had Japan and Germany and Italy working so closely together. But China, yep. Russia, Iran, North Korea are working more closely together now than those countries were in the 1930s.
Mm. Long way to go there. All right, Fred, switching gears. You just published an article on the, quote, complex issue of integrated deterrence as it relates to China and Taiwan. I feel like I just got a master's thesis done there. But in the generous 1 minute we're allotting you, Fred, what does Ukraine and our funding for Ukraine have to do with China and Taiwan?
Well, the word is deterrence. Somehow we're being deterred by Russians' nuclear deterrent, but we're not deterring them. Somehow Iran can hit, Israel as it did over the weekend. We stopped everything there, which is great. But on the other hand, they weren't deterred from trying it. And so we have to restore deterrence. And if China sees that Russia can get away with swallowing Ukraine, or at least destabilizing Ukraine, it could get more tempted to make a move on Taiwan. And President Xi Jinping is in the his third term. It's a record third term. It would end at the end of 2027. That's what we're talking about in the decade of living dangerously. He may well want to swallow Taiwan in that time frame, but he's not a crazy risk taker. He's going to look to see if the cost of swallowing Taiwan would be higher than the gain. And that's where our actions come in, that we have to show that we can deter Russia, China, and Iran all at the same time, which is a very difficult act, but they are interconnected.
Scary stuff, especially because he basically appointed himself China's president effectively for life. We'll see what happens. Fred Kemp, thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, coming up, home free, hardly. Why buyers' hopes for housing may have gotten a lot more complicated and a little more expensive. Next. All right, time now for your Thursday RBI. And tonight we're talking about real estate, the housing market, not the terrific indie band from New Jersey. Because for those of you looking to buy a home, your dream's just getting dashed, or at least getting more expensive. The 30-year fixed-rate mortgage jumped to its highest level this year. According to Redfin, the median home sales price hit $380,250. That is $3,000 shy of 2022's all-time sort of pandemic panic buying-driven record. So prices and borrowing costs are up. That's a pretty toxic combo, I would imagine. And now, the median monthly housing payment hitting a record, $2,775. That's up 11% from a year ago. And that number is even more striking when you kind of zoom out 4 years. The monthly mortgage payment needed to buy the median priced home for sale when rates were down and prices were lower in 2020 was $1,480, that according to Creative Planning's Charlie Bellello. It rose to $1,690 in 2021, then it popped to $2,400 in 2022, and $2,550 last year. It's now $2,775. That is a jump of 88% or so in the last 4 years. Now, all of this and lack of homes for sale is smacking existing home sales. They dropped 4.3% in March. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's the biggest percentage decline in more than a year. To add insult to injury, the cost of insurance premiums, property taxes, maintenance, whatever, have all also gone up, which means costs just keep going up and up. So when will, if, homebuyers see any relief? Let's talk about it with Zillow chief economist Skylar Olson. And Skylar, if you had told me, Brian, we're going to see interest rates spike, but the price of homes will also go up, I would have said that's crazy because people buy homes on the monthly payment. But that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah, well, the reality is, though, that about 70% of sellers are also buyers. So sellers are sensitive in this environment as well. In fact, if we look at the numbers, you know, over March, the fastest appreciating markets were actually the most expensive. They were the California coastal markets. And why was that? Well, those are the places we also saw the most aggressive pullback. Well, a continued pullback, right, from existing owners just not putting their homes on the market for sale. So overall, across the country, we still have this experience of not enough homes, and enough buyers are still willing to move forward. In March, homes successfully priced and well-marketed, popular neighborhoods, the typical home that went pending in March did so still in only 13 days, even at these prices, yeah, even at these mortgage rates. Don't get me wrong, there are places where homes are starting to linger more. Florida and Texas are markets where new listings are back up, perhaps for some of the reasons that you have mentioned, where it's harder for existing owners to maybe, you know, choose to hold on to higher insurance rates that were a surprise to them. So there's a lot of different things going all across this country, but certainly not a dull moment now that mortgage rates are back up.
And again, I can't speak for every market. I mean, every market is local. But when I look at pockets of markets, shocking number of all cash buyers. And they don't care about mortgage rates. They could care less.
Yeah, yeah. And those are actually the same, you know, we mentioned Texas, we mentioned Florida earlier, you know, those are areas where people aren't as locked in for a couple of reasons. One, lots of folks, or at least a larger share of the population, are free and clear on their mortgage, right? They're older boomers. They moved down there with equity growth over the past, you know, 15 years. These are the areas that we're not as locked in. This is where we're seeing a return of inventory, where we are seeing home prices falling. Home prices fell over the year in Austin, New Orleans, right? And are getting very, very soft in kind of other major metros in Texas. So, and actually, because of mortgage rates swinging up, we saw record numbers of price cuts. So a sign that things are slowing down out there on the pricing front, but on net, not necessarily falling, certainly not quickly.
You do wonder if there is a breaking point, though, Skylar, that rates at some point, all the cash runs out. Who knows? Skylar Olson, Zillow, thank you. All right, coming up, an eye for an eye. DJT, the stock, striking back at short sellers. Who will win the battle? Referee Herb Greenberg is next. All right, welcome back to Last Call. Let's turn now to the roller coaster ride that is DJT. That, of course, is Trump Media and Tech. Now, the stock rocketing today, up nearly 26%. That is the second straight day of big gains, but it comes after big declines. Now, the fuel today coming from a new frequently asked questions section for investors on Trump Media's website. It gives tips on how to block short sellers from targeting the stock. The suggestions include holding DJT shares in a cash account instead of a margin account, opting out of securities lending programs, moving shares to Odyssey Transfer and Trust, that is the company's transfer agent, or transferring the stock to a bank and holding company and putting them in a retirement account. That has helped turbocharge trading activity on DJT, nearly 17.7 million shares changing hands today. That, while not a lot for a lot of stocks, is nearly triple the average of the previous 2 weeks. Let's talk more about a guy who's been on this stock from the beginning. That is contributor Herb Greenberg, the co-founder of a new media investment platform called Wall Street Beats. Congrats on the launch, Herb. I know it'll
Thank
do great.
You, Brian.
But let's talk about DJT. Wild run up, wild run down, wild run up. What's going on here?
Well, that's what you get when you get involved in some sort of lottery ticket, and that's what this stock is a lottery ticket. But all you really need to know at this point in the cycle, and this is a cycle because we don't know where it's going to be, is what they did today with that sort of FAQ on how to, you know, take your stock and not lend it out to short sellers. I mean, think about it on the surface. That's basically a way, and the way, at least the way I look at it, that they are basically taking the story, trying to control the story, trying to twist it around, divert attention from what any investor should be looking at, which is the fundamentals of the company, and sort of put it over here and create a new enemy, an attempted enemy, which is, for many people, the short seller. So now you create that friction, and you have people looking there. Because think about it this way, Brian. With a stock this thin, and in a sense, even though it's traded a bunch, it's thin. You know, Trump himself owns 60% of the shares. You theoretically would want the shorts in this stock. You do not want them out of this stock, because if you are going to perform the way you think and you're going to have some great news, this stock will squeeze much higher. And the worst thing for a company this, and I've called it very speculative, is to leave the short, have the shorts sort of like hold away, because if and then there is a situation that causes investors to get spooked, it's the elevator shaft down. Because there's no natural
It's always buyer. The emperor. It's the evil emperor, the short seller behind the scenes of the shadows. That's the problem with everything, not just us. China is always blaming short sellers when their market goes down. I know the views. I know your views. We won't go into that. But, I mean, to your point, the company has almost no sales. Just tell people. Look, it could go up. It could go down. This is a gamble. You're gambling.
This is somebody asked me today, said, I have some friends who are trying to analyze the stock. What should they do? And I said, look, I can't tell them what to do. But what I
analyze
can tell
what?
You is that's the point. I said, what are you analyzing? This in the best of times, looking at X/Twitter. This is a difficult business. And this company has shown how difficult it is, because despite how strong the brand of Donald J. Trump may be, they haven't been able to convert that to revenue. And, you know, there's this whole thing they say in the business, and I certainly know it as doing what I do for a living. There are fans and there are customers. And there's a very big difference when people, you know, when you have to get people in the door. And in this one, he can get fans in the door. And even that hasn't been that great. But for him in this business or for this company, it's advertisers. And I've heard what Devin Nunes, the CEO, has said about future streaming deals and all. Good luck. And maybe, you know what? I can't see the future. Who knows? But I can tell you right now, at this level, I said it here once, I'll say it again. If it wasn't for the brand premium of DJT, of Donald J. Trump, this would be a penny stock.
Well, about 20 seconds from Philadelphia. Hey, congrats on Wall Street Beats, by the way. I look forward to seeing what it's like, and maybe I'll pop up once in a while. Herb, thank you. Congrats.
Thank you.
You and your entire team. All right. Herb Greenberg, always consummate entrepreneur. Folks, that's it for Last Call Live from Philadelphia. I'll see you on the Halftime Report tomorrow. Shark Tank is next.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.